Well, I'm delighted to have you here.
Thank you, Don.
My broadcast does focus primarily on fiction and literature, and I've had some of the outstanding writers of our period on this broadcast, so glad to add your name to that list.
Yeah, I hope it belongs there.
It does, indeed. And I did not need the New York Times book review to tell me that The Great Fake Book was a wonderful novel. It's a long book, but I think I read it in effectively a sitting and a half.
That's exactly what I wanted you to say.
I spent most of a Sunday reading it and a portion of a Saturday, and I certainly enjoyed it. How did the book evolve in your mind? How did it come about?
Well, I suppose I always wanted to write out of my frustration of being unable to play the trumpet very well, and to create a character who, like myself, is unable to play the cornet very well, but has a lot of fun trying anyway, and is emotionally involved with jazz, with that kind of music, as an important part of his life. And is able, though he's not good enough to be able to do it for a living, he's able to define certain parts of himself by what he can do. And this, to deal with that was something I probably had in mind for 30 years or so, and I've took me this long to find a particular way to do it.
Well, that's an oversimplification of the book. It's a much more complex story that has many different elements, and a very unusual approach, because the story of Mike
Mazurin
is a story within a story, a novel within a novel. So you have quite a few other elements involved in here, not just your own frustration with not being able to
play that well. You asked me about the inception of it, the starting point. Any book having departed from its starting point seldom gets anywhere close to it again, because the starting point is like a springboard. You know, you do a dive, and then it's what you do in the way of turning wheels and stuff in the air, and how cleanly you meet the water that determines the book, and the springboard is forgotten. But, you know, you're right. There's a lot of story complication in this novel. I think probably some of the other stories are more interesting than the story of the man who is as a frustrated musician. I hope that some of the parts of the book that deal with the last days of Jimmy Carter's Washington and the imminence of Ronald Reagan's Washington and so on should, or certainly of more current interest than the stuff that takes place back in Mike Mazurin's youth, which is the end of the Second World War.
Did you start writing the Mike Mazurin portion of the book initially first?
Yes. Mm-hmm. and realized that wonderful post-war period, which is so important to people in their late 50s and 60s like myself, really doesn't mean all that all that much to most of today's readers. You know, one must be able to relate that period of time to this period of time and show that something happened in the 30 to 40 years interval, which is relevant to the lives of people living now. And I think something did happen. I think something very interesting happened. You invited me to pontificate, Don.
Please.
I'm going to do it. I think that we came out of the Second World War as a nation with a great deal of optimism and faith in ourselves as a kind of good people, faith in the world as a world in which, once we got into control, we were going to be able to have pretty decent lives in a pretty decent country in a pretty decent world. And things looked very good even through the Eisenhower years. And with the election of John Kennedy, the optimism reached a kind of peak. We really felt great about ourselves. And when John Kennedy was killed, something really happened to this country. It started to happen, which may have begun with the assassination, but then it went on through the Vietnam years, the protests, the civil rights agonies, the Watergate scandal, the fact that we had a president who could be impeached, a vice president who was a crook, just one kind of corruption and disappointment, dismay after another, and the kind of crest of optimism that we had reached with Kennedy was absolutely destroyed. And we went through this 20-year period, which maybe we're now coming out of, I'm not sure, of a real kind of forced and unwanted cynical sophistication in American life, which I think is reflected in the way people talk and behave in the Washington parts of my novel. Where you look for hope now, I don't know. We don't lose it, but sometimes it's hard to find.
Back to the structure of the book, if you could talk about that a little bit. You said you had written the Mike of Mazurin part of the novel first. Then what happened? Did you look for a bed within to lay this portion of the book?
Pretty much. Well, I had not developed his part of the book as a narrative, as a plot. I had touched it as a kind of writing, a tone, a sort of peon to those optimistic days I was talking about. But it had to be, as it had to be set off against something. And it seemed to me what it had to be set off against was today. What's happening now? That if it has any meaning for us now, if how we felt then as young men coming out of the war and young women coming out of the war, if that meant anything to our children who are now sort of coming into control, that we had to acknowledge that their world is of quite a different world. The tone of life is quite a different tone. And to try to show how one did grow out of the other. And it seems to me that, as I say, if there's hope to be taken or laughter to be laughed, it's got to come out of that sense of perspective of, sure, we've come down a long road, but there have been some curious and unhappy turns in the road, but there have also been some good times, and there's still good times. And, you know, it mostly takes a kind of nourishing of that sense of hope, which we perhaps can get out of thinking about the past a little bit, to face up to the present and do our best with it and keep laughing.
Well, you certainly, I think you tied all the strings together by the end, and all of the characters were accounted for, and they all had interrelationships, of course, but I don't think there were any dangling ends. I think you caught everything there, which is not always easy to do. Sometimes you read a book and a character vanishes in the second or third chapter, and you wonder by the end whatever happened to him, but I think you've accounted for everybody in the book. And that is no mean feat, because you have a lot of people in that book, and they come in and out rather abruptly, and they surprise you. And so you have a very unusual stylistic approach with this book, which is not, I guess, that much different than not playing in Canterbury. You used this unusual stylistic approach. It's not what John Barth would say, a straight novel.
Right. Now, I one of my loves is for American voices, the way Americans talk and express themselves. And I like, as often as I can, to take the author out of the book and let the characters speak for themselves in their own words, in a kind of what I find to be a real American poetry, the poetry of common speech. And that common speech, the way people write letters, as I say, the way people who are not writers express themselves, I find very moving sometimes, and very full of entertainment and energy. I think writers can learn an awful lot from just listening to their fellow countrymen. And so this is a book in which I did a lot of listening and trying, in which I tried to recreate the kind of voices I hear and the kind of voices I read in people who are not writers. And I think there's some fun in it. I just love the way Americans talk.
Well, let's go back to where it all began. Cleveland, Ohio, 1922. Tell me about Cleveland and those early years, or those formative years for you. First of all, I should ask you, Bourgeli, what kind of name is that?
Bourgeli is a Lebanese name. It's one of those Abu Arabic names which starts with Abu. This was Abu Rajali. My father was an immigrant from Lebanon who became a newspaper man.
How did he find his way to Cleveland?
I'm not sure. After the First World War, he had been a newspaper man in Syracuse. He went over to France in the First World War as an aviator, and was General Pershing's aide-de-camp for aviation, which meant nothing because, you know, the Air Force was nothing in World War One.
But he was an American citizen, obviously.
He was by then an American citizen. And he came back and pursued the newspaper career and got to Cleveland, where he was on the City Hall beat at the Plain Dealer, where my mother, who was an Ohio farm girl, was the sob sister. And they got together and were married and had three sons, and I was one of them. We left Cleveland fairly early. I was brought up up and down the East Coast. But Dad and Mother both stayed in the newspaper business and both continued writing. They both wrote all their lives for their living, so it was probably inevitable that one of their sons would write for his living.
That's right. Now, I can see why you touch on the things you know, obviously, and I can see why you got the newspaper portion of the book as well. Where up and down the East Coast did you live?
Well, my mother and father were divorced when I was about 12. Dad lived on in New York, where he continued to be a newspaper man. And my mother lived down in Virginia, so I split my time between New York and Virginia. Graduated from high school down there, went to college finally in Maine, where by then my father had become newspaper editor in Bangor. And I went to a little college called Bowdoin up in Maine.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Partly as a result of Dad's being in Bangor. I had intended to go to Harvard, but I couldn't get a scholarship there. My father pulled some kind of string in the state of Maine, and I found myself with a scholarship at Bowdoin, so that's where I went to school.
You have a little difficulty having a specific route as a writer. I mean, you can't identify yourself as a Middle Western writer or a Southern writer or a New England writer. You seem to have covered a lot of territory in those early years.
I think you're very accurate. I have no geographical route, but I find myself very much rooted in this time period, which is the end of the Second World War to about 1970. The things that happened between about 45 and 70 are the things that moved me and made me, and the things that I find enough emotional charge in to want to deal with in fiction. So this time period, this American time period, seems to me to be where I'm rooted, and something that I keep trying to deal with.
Now, in college, what did you study? What was your intention to be at that point in your life?
Well, I never really thought I could manage to be anything but a writer. When I was a kid, when I was a little boy, 7 or 8 years old, I thought maybe I could be an actor. But that didn't work. I started writing very early and really never intended to do anything much else.
When you say early, how early?
Well, I could recite for you, and since you seem to be a nice fellow, I won't, a poem which I wrote when I was 8.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
All right. It's called The Dance of the Fireflies, and it goes like this. The fireflies, one autumn night, went dancing with their little lights. From 10 to 12 they danced all night till they and the beetles began to fight. They fought and fought till 1:30, and the result was the fireflies won.
Well, that's not bad. That's better than I could write, and I'm 50, so that's not bad at all.
Well, let's hope this interview doesn't go into print, because I haven't really wanted to preserve that.
Well, now, so you must have had a great deal of encouragement from your parents, who were obviously both writers.
My mother particularly was very interested in producing a son who would be a writer of some kind of significance. She herself wrote popular novels and magazine fiction, and she sort of graduated from newspaper work up a couple of steps, but she was by no means unsophisticated as far as literature went. She used to lecture on Emily Dickinson, and she read very widely, and yes, her ambitions for me are certainly embodied in the work I've done since. I'm not sure how much of it she would have liked.
So you were an English major?
English and philosophy.
What happened after college?
Well, what happened to me was what happened to everybody who went to college about 1940. We left college and went to war for 4 years. And so really, I think probably our college education was the Second World War. We took a few courses at schools, but obviously we grew up during the war.
Were you mustered out of the service in that same little town in North Carolina that you write about in the book?
A very similar one, though I didn't
have any mouthpieces on the way out, did you?
You know, I bought my first cornet. I bought it with my mustering out pay, and it was several weeks before I could even get a sound out of it. But I was sitting around in a cabin in Virginia, which in a town not unlike Faraday, working on my first novel and trying to teach myself to play the trumpet. The first novel turned out better than the trumpet playing did.
Well, I want to ask you about that in a moment, but you're in the service. Where were you stationed? What did you do to
it came in two parts. On the first part of the war, I was with the British Army as an ambulance driver in an organization called the American Field Service. The second part of the war, I was with the American, and that was in the Middle East and Syria, Egypt, the Western Desert, and Italy. The second part of the war, I was in the U.S. infantry and in the Pacific, though not in combat. We went to Hawaii, and then we went and occupied Japan.
Well, how did this division of the war happen? You obviously volunteered to go.
Right, and then when the period of for which I volunteered was up, instead of re-enlisting in the field service, I decided I'd subject myself to what everybody else was going through and just go into the American Army, which, in a way for bad reason, a good reason personally. I wanted the experience in the field service where I was a volunteer with the British was too exceptional. It wasn't what everybody else my age was going through. And since I saw myself as a writer, and it seemed to me it was very important to have in common, you know, the important experiences of my generation, I think for that reason, as much as anything else, decided I'd do the American Army and take infantry training, be a private, and all that.
Well, I have to ask you parenthetically, I know this sounds like a very disjointed interview. It won't sound that way on the air. You said your mother was an Ohio farm girl, so mm-hmm. She was not Lebanese.
She was not Lebanese, no. Her name was Webb.
So they didn't, in other words, your parents didn't come over together.
Right.
Or anything. Okay. After the war, you said that you were in Virginia working on your first novel. Now tell me about that.
Well, up until December of 1945, I had thought of myself as a writer, but I was going to be either a poet or a playwright or both. In December of 1945, I was participating in the occupation of Japan, and I got a cable from a literary agent in New York who represented my mother, as a matter of fact, and he said, Max Perkins of Scribner's has read your play and will give you a $700 advance if you're willing to write a novel. And I immediately ceased to be a poet and a playwright and became a novelist on receipt of that cable. Of course, cabled back, yes, and as soon as I got out of the Army, I started work on the novel.
Tell me what that novel was all about. That was 1947.
Everybody's first novel is from that period is a war novel. Mine was. It's called The End of My Life. And it's a novel about somebody, actually mostly based on the American Field Service experience, the ambulance driving in the Middle East and Italy. And it was duly published by Scribner's, edited by Perkins. Did reasonably well critically, but made no great impact otherwise. And
that's hard, though, isn't it? Unless there are some overriding aspects about the book for a first novelist to make an impact in terms of reaching an audience. And it's difficult, isn't it?
It was a great and interesting kind of disillusionment to me, in a way, because I had assumed that all one had to do was publish this first novel and the world would know and applaud and support the rest of the career. That isn't the way it happens. And, you know, I remembered vividly, Don, that on publication day, which was, I believe, August 15th of 1947, I woke up expecting the world to be different, and it wasn't. In fact, no telegrams came, no bells rang, no drums were beaten, and at that moment, I thought, you know, I should have been a playwright because at least opening night is an event, but publication day is not. Today, for example, is the publication day of this new book we've been talking about, and you were the main event of it. Thank you for being.
Well, unfortunately, since it's on tape, it won't air on publication day. I'm sorry about that. Well, what was the feeling like when you picked up this novel, this first book, The End of My Life, the first thing you had published? What was that feeling like?
It felt real good. I can't remember all that well, but it was the occasion of a party. Not a party thrown by a publisher in New York, but we were up, my first wife and I were up in Maine at college at the time I was about to graduate, and we saw our friends and had some drinks and whooped it up a bit. I went down to Portland to a department store to autograph that book, and this was a day or two after publication day. And I was standing in the book department at Porteous Mitchell and Braun when a lady came in and wanted to buy a book. And so the book buyer directed her to me. She said, well, we have this author here. Maybe you'd like his book. And so the woman came over, and she asked me about my book, and I described it to her as well as I could. And she said, oh, well, all right, I'll take it. And I said, okay, would you like me to autograph it? And she said, autograph it. And I said, yeah, would you like me to write my name in it? And she said, oh, that would be all right if it was for myself, but you see, it's a gift.
Now, you were still in college when you wrote the book.
Yeah.
So you had entered college after the service.
Well, no, I entered college before the service and left college for 4 years and then went back afterwards just for a couple of semesters to finish up.
To finish up. But
yeah. That was a very common thing. And
yeah. Effectively, though, you were still in college when you wrote the novel.
Right.
Probably helped to give you a good grade.
I think my English instructors were reasonably odd.
I would think so. But what happened after graduation?
Did some newspaper work for a while, wrote another book. Second book was...
Where did you work on the newspaper?
Well, the biggest newspaper I worked for was the San Francisco Chronicle, where I had a little time on general assignment, but then I started doing feature writing. I was really too slow a writer for general assignment. Never fast enough to be a good newspaper man. But I could do feature stories reasonably well if there wasn't too much time pressure. And I did that for years, too. And came to New York, edited a magazine called Discovery, which had a certain vogue at its time. It's where the young writers published in the early 50s.
I
have a copy.
First issue of Discovery, in fact.
Yeah. Well, that was where people like Starman and Mailer and the guys who were starting to emerge. My magazine was one of the places where they published. Yeah.
Yes, in fact, Styron's second novel, actually a novella called Long March in Here, was the first appearance of that story,
right.
that book, which later became published by, I believe it was published by...
Random House.
Random House as a paperback, and later as a hardcover book, and it's been in print ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first issue. That, the Styron book, I must have... The Styron story, what's it called? Time of My Time?
Long March is...
No, I'm not. I mean the Mailer.
Oh, the Mailer story. I think the one we had was...
Time of My Time.
Is it called The Dead Gook?
Well, maybe I'm wrong. That was...
I believe it's The Dead Gook.
Yeah, The Dead Gook. Yeah. And Herb Gold?
Yep. Well, we all knew each other, knew one another around New York at that time. We were all young, all...
How did Discovery come about, exactly?
It came about in imitation of a very successful British series called Penguin New Writing, which the big paperback firm had done before the war in England, and was the place in which the young British writers, people like Isherwood and Auden and so on, first published in Penguin New Writing, and it looked like something that our paperback companies ought to be doing as they started making money. So John Alderton and I took the idea to Pocket Books, and they said, sure. And so we did 6 issues of Discovery before Pocket Books decided that they didn't want to be magazine publishers after all. But the 6 issues were over the course of 3 years, and it had some effect. I still meet people who read Discovery as kids. And
it's really a hybrid, though. It's while you cover, you call it a magazine, it's in the form of a paperback book.
Well, it was followed by, though there was a New American Library similar thing, a new writing anthology.
New American Writing, I think it's called.
Yeah, I haven't quite got New World Writing.
Yeah, that's it.
New World Writing. And then when both Discovery and New World Writing had folded, they were followed by New American Review, which Ted Solitaroff edited and which came out as a paperback book a couple of times a year, I think. So the idea persisted for a while. And I don't think there's anything quite like it now, but...
Well, let's go back. I'm a little confused about the chronology. I hope you understand that I just want to have an idea about, since I plan to make this broadcast in a multiple series as a profile.
Sure.
So I'm trying to get some idea. So after you graduated, you said you worked on some newspapers,
mm-hmm.
and you wound up. Did you wind up at the San Francisco Chronicle?
No. We came to New York from San Francisco. I had been on the Chronicle. We came to New York, and I got going on this Discovery.
Did you come to New York for the purpose of working on Discovery?
No, I came to New York because it seemed like New York was the place for a young writer to be. And it was here that I I managed to get the opportunity to do Discovery, here that I wrote my second novel, and that was followed for me and for a number of other writers by a period of 2 or 3 years expatriation in Mexico City. We all sort of discovered Mexico City. Mailer, I guess, was the most prominent. Mailer was the most prominent of the writers that went down there, but a number of us did move to Mexico City for 2 or 3 years.
Were you there at the time of Burroughs?
I didn't know Burroughs then. No. I think he was there a bit later. Mm-hmm. Bud Schulberg was there. Willard Motley was there. George Mandel was there. And a number of other people. It's a pretty lively community. And then we drifted back to New York in the middle 50s, where I wrote some television, and I was drama critic on the Village Voice. And in the course of all that, managed to get my third novel written. Which,
what was the Village Voice experience like? I guess you developed that job through Mailer, huh?
Yeah, some of Mailer's friends were the editor and publisher of it. And they let me review Broadway, which was fun. And
well, the Village Voice is nice because they don't give you a time limit. You can write as long as you want and as boringly as you want.
Well, I don't recall that there were no... I think there were space constraints when I worked for it. And whether there were boredom constraints, I'm not sure, but...
Did you read The Voice today?
I haven't seen it recently, but... A little long-winded, is it?
Well, the writers there are not edited. You know, they're given allowed full steam ahead. They can do much of what they want. It's an interesting publication. It's owned by Rupert Murdoch, who has not
didn't realize that. That's
fascinating. He's bought it. He's bought everything. But he has not tried to impose his conservative approach, and it's making money. If you pick it up, you'll see it's that thick, and it's got a million ads.
Uh-huh. Well,
it's doing okay.
Apparently, I'll have to get some help to lift it then.
Yeah. Well, now you went from New York, where you started Discovery. You went to Mexico. You came back. You worked on the Village Voice. At some point, however, you began teaching.
I left New York in 1957. Went out to Iowa City, Iowa, which was the Wild West, as far as I was concerned. And I was still there teaching at the Iowa Writers' Workshop 22 years later.
What kind of experience was that? You had 22 years. You must have liked that a lot.
Well, it was a very productive place to be.
In State City in Canterbury.
State City in Canterbury, right.
Iowa City.
Yeah. It was the University of Iowa supported the arts. They were willing to agree that what painters painted and composers composed and writers wrote had the same importance to the university as the research of the physicists and the chemists and the social scientists. And so they gave us the same kind of release time. They supported us during the same periods of release time as they would other scholars, which enabled us to write and paint and compose. And it was a very, as I say, very productive situation. During those 22 years, I wrote 7 books. And one every 3 years, which is a good enough pace for me.
Well, Paul Engle was the head of the program.
Right. It was Paul's creation, and his imagination really created that.
That's really... I don't think there is another university in the United States that has anything near to the commitment that Iowa does to the writing program.
Stanford has the next oldest and most important, but there are at least 100 other schools by now which have writing programs derived from Iowa. There's a very important one at the University of Arizona, which I left Iowa to teach in for 5 years. And there's a brand new one at Louisiana State University, which I direct, mm-hmm. but it's much smaller. But now Paul Engle's vision of a workshop supported by a university has spread through the country by now, and there are a lot of programs.
Well, Iowa certainly has produced a lot of famous writers. Some were students and others taught there, but it's obviously the best known and probably the biggest. So you found that a very fulfilling period then, huh?
I did indeed, yes.
What about the students? I've heard that it's very difficult to actually teach writing. So how do you do it? Is it a process of motivation? Because you don't really sit there with a student try to tell him exactly how to write.
Well, to some extent, it's motivation is important. It's I sometimes think it's more like trying to coach athletes, but in an individual sport, say runners or something like that, than it is like normal teaching. The talent must be there, obviously. The kid must be able to break 10 seconds in the 100-yard dash. And how you, the little things that you can show the student technically are probably not all that important. What is more important is creating an atmosphere in which it's very important to develop as a writer, in which the goal means a great deal to the whole little community of people involved, in which there's excitement about writing, about literature, in which there's the feeling that if you have the talent and work hard and do the work, it will be recognized and rewarded. And it's all, as I say, what really is involved is less a matter of teaching than the creation of a community of writers, all of whom have the same kind of goal for themselves and the same kind of pride in the work they do. When a university will support something like that, interesting things happen.
How many actually turn out to be writers? It would seem to me that probably a small percentage, actually, but it would also seem to me that this sort of program would be very good in simply expanding the mind in a creative way so that the person can use this experience in some other profession.
Well, it's got to be, because obviously of the 100 people at the Iowa Writers' Workshop every year, there are going to be no more than one or two stars, and every 5 years there's going to be a superstar. I think you could fairly make the analogy to a football program or a Juilliard program for musicians. No, a lot of the people are going to be high school football coaches on the one hand, or music teachers on the other hand, or maybe get entirely out of athletics or music, or in my case, literature. But those couple of years of working and experimenting and trying your wings and so on, teach you things which I hope apply in other fields of life, because surely very few of the actual graduates of the program are going to make it as writers.
Who were some of your stars over that 22-year period?
Who were some of the writers?
Your stars, some of the students that you had.
Well, I think probably the best known would be John Irving. John's done real well. Gail Godwin was at Iowa while I was there. Tom McHale. There are any number of them, actually. A great many in the field of poetry. Perhaps more poets whose names would be recognized by poets than novelists whose names would be recognized by the public. But the public doesn't recognize the names of a lot of novelists anyway, who are very good. We had, I would say about every 2 or 3 years, we had somebody outstanding who has gone on to publish with real distinction since. And if Irving is the most visible of them, that doesn't mean that the others aren't pretty good, too.
What was living like out there on the prairies?
I loved it. I had a farm, and I became quite an outdoor guy, actually. There's a good deal of outdoors in my boyhood, and so I liked getting back to the outdoors. Still enjoy it.
So you were never bored?
No.
Because that's a small, relatively small town. I would imagine almost all of the events are built, all of the activities are built around the university.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. But I didn't even participate all that much in the university activities. I was out on the farm and in the woods a good deal. And that, I'm not much of a city guy.
So what, after 22 years at Iowa, where did you go?
Went to Arizona, did very much the same thing for 5 years. And last year...
It was like the heat. Because Iowa is not exactly chilly in the summer, is it?
No, it gets very warm in the summer, but ice cold in the winter. It was nice to get away from the winters. And I'm down in New Orleans now, I'm doing the same kind of thing at Louisiana State University.
Did you launch the program there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you have to do to start a creative writing program?
Get some money.
How do you do that?
Well, you have to be given some money by the graduate college, which has decided it wants a program launched. And that's pretty much the way it happens. They just decide they want to expand their graduate offering in English to include a writing program, and they find somebody to run it for them.
So you're offering a master's degree?
A master of fine arts, which is a terminal degree. It's a 3-year degree. And if you hold it, you presumably do not need a PhD. You've got all the education you need to go teach writing.
What's it like living in New Orleans?
Well, New Orleans is a big party town. The party's on the streets every weekend. And it's sometimes fun to be able to get out on the street and join the party.
Do you live in New Orleans itself?
We do, yes. Which means I have to drive over to Baton Rouge, 80 miles away, where the university is, a couple of days a week.
So the university is in Baton Rouge?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you have quite a commute then? Huh?
Well, I don't. When I drive over, I generally stay in Baton Rouge a night or two and then go back to New Orleans when the work is done.
Robert Olin Butler's not teaching there, is he?
Robert Olin Butler? No. No,
Robert
sir.
Olin Butler. He just has a new book out. No, he is teaching in Louisiana, but I couldn't remember the name of the college. His last book, he has a brand new one. It just came out. Can't remember the title. His last one was a very well-reviewed book called On Distant Ground. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ran across that, but he was very excited. Last time I talked to him, he was commuting to Long Island. He was working for Fairchild Publications, and I think it was a business magazine of some kind. So this was his first teaching job. He was very excited.
He liked it.
Excited about going down to Louisiana to live. I have kind of mixed feelings about New Orleans. I've been down there a number of times, and the last time I was down there, it was in August, and it was one could not breathe, and it was just struck me as little decrepit at that time. But it may have been just the heat, because I just really hit me somehow. That I
New Orleans is very much living in its past. I think your sense of the place is quite accurate. Most of the energy that comes there is tourists coming to participate in some kind of reenactment of that past. The things that happen there that are genuine and current are tremendous enthusiasm for food. The restaurants are all they're said to be.
Well, it certainly attracted a lot of writers who have taken a lot of satisfaction in living in the French Quarter. Robert Stone and Tennessee Williams. Anne Rice, and on and on and on.
And Shirley Ann Growl is there now, and of course Walker Percy lives close by. It's a satisfying town. The thing that bothers me mostly about it, and I think would bother me any place in the Deep South, is the prevalent problem of race, which I never have had to try to deal with before.
Is that really a problem now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a racial division. New Orleans is quite a well-integrated city, but there's a great deal of racial division. There's a great deal of discrimination still. There's a great deal of de facto segregation, even though it's against the law.
Well, I hear the Southern politicians, they say the South has solved all their integration problems, and all the problems are up here in the North. But that's not the case.
That is not the case. I could illustrate it, Don, by something as simple as taking the written test for a driver's license. The questions are so phrased in such complex language that my wife and I, both of whom teach at college, found it very difficult to decide from reading the question what the answer should be because of the complexity with which the question is phrased. This, I won't say, is obviously intended to keep black people from getting driver's licenses, but it certainly, in effect, does. And there's that kind of hidden discrimination is pervasive in Louisiana life, and I would assume in other southern states.
Of course, the questions could have been written by lawyers.
I'm sure they were white lawyers.
Well, I grew up in Houston, Texas, which is not far away, and when you went to the park, of course, there were two drinking fountains, and the blacks sat in the back of the bus, and then the balcony of the motion picture theaters, but I didn't know that was racism. Yeah. I had no idea. It was just a way of life.
Right. Well, that part of it's gone now, but the problem's by no means solved.
Well, I can sense that you have mixed feelings about New Orleans.
I do,
You're going to stay there?
Yeah. We'll stay for a while. I'd like to do this job well. And
how long have you been there?
This is my second year.
How do you order your day and your time? Do you always have a writing project?
I try to work every morning then do whatever else needs to be done in the afternoon.
Is there, you had mentioned Shirley and Grau, is there a little literary colony down there where you have people?
No,
you
can... there isn't really. I have not met her. There are no events which, you know, which gather up the literary people in town. In fact, in many cases, I don't think they know of one another. It's not, it's much more, it of course is a big music community, and that's the chief cultural interest in New Orleans. Painting is a strong cultural interest down there. Writing, even though, as you say, a good many writers have been attracted to the city, it's not really a writer's city in the sense that writers are important to people in New Orleans. I'm not sure why, but...
Do you ever get a chance to take a crack at the Coronet at Preservation Hall? Or would you like to?
Oh, yeah, if those guys were tolerant enough to let me take a course of Bye Bye Blackbird, I'd be delighted.
Well, thank you for letting me take you through your life story. I wanted to know about you and have some sense about where you came from and what you've done. And are you working on, do you have something that we can expect in the, well,
first,
we really can't
another.
Expect something from you too soon, can we? Just,
well,
this
my,
is publication day. That's really an unfair question, isn't it?
My agent just gave me hell because this book had taken 6 years to write, and he said, the next one better not take that long, and I agree with him. It's a point well made.
Well, you've got other things to do. It's not, though you're writing... exclusively, you have classes to teach and lessons to take.
I think I better get in a situation where I can write a little more exclusively, Don.
Well, Vance Borghele, The Great Fake Book is a wonderful novel. I certainly enjoyed it, and you're easy to talk to, and well, I appreciate very much that you took the time to come in and talk with me.
Thank you, Don.